Well, a few weeks ago when I was at the X conference in Washington, D.C., Graham Hancock came up to me and introduced himself. He's been on the program before, but we had never met. Well, he's here now on Coast to Coast AM, and he's next. Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about humanity's history and prehistory and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars. Graduating from Durham University, first-class honors in sociology, he then went on to pursue a career in quality journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. Here he is, full program tonight with Graham Hancock on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, how are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
Likewise. It was great meeting you out there.
It was great, and what a wonderful event that was. Yes, it was fantastic to meet you, and I thought a lot of really intriguing ideas were aired at that conference.
Does it add to the program and to the interview when you know face-to-face who's interviewing you?
I just wanted
to ask somebody.
Yeah, it definitely does. When we've talked a few times on the phone, and you get to know the other person on the phone, but there's nothing like that face-to-face contact and actually meeting the person and seeing how that person is to really cement that connection, I think.
So true, so true. Yeah. And it makes, I think, a more well-rounded conversation, too.
It does. I mean, this is one of the great things about your show, that it has the feel, of a couple of old friends who are getting together to discuss important matters, and there's that kind of warmth and connection to it that actually, to be honest, you don't find on that many other shows.
Later on, you can give us updates on Fingerprints of the Gods, but you've got a new work out called Supernatural. Tell me a little bit about this, and how did we get into that?
Well, it was a strange process for me because, as you know, and perhaps some of your listeners know, over the last 15 years, I've been focusing on the possibility that there could have been a lost civilization, that there's a great untold story in our history and prehistory, and I've looked very much at the last sort of 10 or 12,000 years in that perspective, and really having finished with Fingerprints of the Gods and Underworld, where I took that quest underwater and spent 5 years scuba diving all around the world, I felt that I had reached the point where I wanted to venture into something a bit new, a bit different. And I really thought what I would do is go back and look at the mystery of human origins, go back much further, perhaps even millions of years. And this was the genesis of my book, Supernatural. But like all books, when you really start to wrestle with them and get to grips with them, you find yourself steered by the book itself in a direction that you did not expect to go. And that's what happened to me with Supernatural. I found myself steered in a complete... I thought I was going to be writing about, the missing link and more of a mainstream story of human evolution. But I found myself instead confronted by an extraordinary mystery and by a period of human prehistory which is truly strange and eerie. I mean, to cut a long story short, what I found is that most of the story of human evolution, certainly as it's accepted by mainstream scholars, is incredibly dull. In fact, I call it 6 million years of boredom, really, from the last common ancestor with a chimpanzee about 6 million years ago, through to anatomically modern humans slightly less than 200,000 years ago. And the boring behavior, the non-innovative thinking, the evidence that our ancestors could not think laterally or creatively, had no sense of the abstract. Weirdly, this continues even after they become anatomically modern, even after they look just like you and me, with the same brain size as we do. Their behavior carries on being, I think the word really is uninnovative. There is just no innovation. They get locked into rigid patterns of behavior, and they never, never change it. And then really quite suddenly, all over the world, somewhere shortly after 40,000 years ago, something really extraordinary happens to our ancestors everywhere. It's like a huge wave of enlightenment just sweeps across them. And in an instant, they become recognizable through their behavior, the traces of which they have left in the archaeological record, they become recognizable as us. We realize that we're dealing not with basically, ape men who happen to look like us, but actually us with the same sensitivities, the same feelings. It's all suddenly there at once, fully formed, as though somebody has turned on a light switch. And the greatest evidence for this really comes from two things. Suddenly, our ancestors start burying their dead, and they do so in a reverential way, and they bury with them items of food and water. This has never happened before. And what it tells us is that they have got to grips, they've grappled with the concept that some part of the individual survives physical death, that we are more than our physical selves, that something goes on. That concept is very, very clearly evident in their burials. And the second thing that happens exactly the same time, and it's difficult to say, you know, which is cause or which is effect, or whether they're both effects of some other cause, is that they start creating the most majestic and extraordinary art. Art which Picasso, when he first visited it at the Cave of Lascaux in France, he came out and admitted frankly to reporters, we have invented nothing. Those ancient artists knew everything that we knew, and they thought in abstract ways and created the most extraordinary images that are truly eerie. When you go into these underground caves in southern France and Spain and other parts of Europe, which go back, in some cases, 35,000 years, you find yourself in vast, echoing cathedrals of the spirit, which are decorated and painted in the most eerie and touching and poignant manner. Great beauty is unveiled before you, and they've used the rock face, and you almost get a sense that they're telling you that on the other side of the rock face is another world, inhabited by strange beings who sometimes appear in part animal and part human form. And sometimes, and we'll get into this, there are a number of examples of this, appear in a form that any of us today, familiar with the popular media, would recognize as a gray, as what we think of as the typical alien. There are a number of images, more than 25,000 years old, in the caves, which show that kind of figure very, very clearly and very distinctly. So this is all very weird. And at the same time, our ancestors' economic behavior starts to become much more sophisticated. Their hunting strategies are radically overhauled. They become incredibly efficient and cunning. Their weapons and tools take a quantum leap forward. So something has happened to them, and this is why the subtitle of my book, the title is Supernatural, the subtitle is Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind, because I cannot resist the conclusion that some encounter happened to our ancestors at that point that switched us on, that put us on a new track. And that's what I ended up focusing on, and that's what I ended up investigating, is what was it? What was that extraordinary moment in human history that made us fully human for the first time?
Your work somewhat similar to Michael Cremo's, or one could say Michael Cremo's work somewhat similar to yours.
Well, I think that I would say that they're complementary in a way. Michael goes down some tracks that I don't go down. Michael has presented a huge amount of evidence for which I know Michael personally. He's a wonderful man, a fantastic researcher, really has done the most incredible work, which I would recommend to everyone. And he has documented quite a few strange and mysterious exceptions to the accepted evolutionary story. And suggested that actually anatomically modern humans may have been present on the planet much earlier, millions of years ago, not hundreds of thousands of years ago. Now, I don't go there in my book. Over the years, I've been obliged to spend so much of my time fighting with mainstream academics that about my own view of history, my own take on the possibility of a lost civilization, I found that I And it almost seems like a strategy on their part that I end up getting bogged down in these arguments with orthodox academics.
That's how they contain you, Graham.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's how they contain us all, is that they pick some little quibble or niggle with your argument and then try to expand it out into something which can, you know, which they claim destroys the whole argument. And so instead of actually, you see, I see my role as advancing ideas that perhaps other people aren't advancing. I think the whole area of inquiry into what it is to be human is an open area. I don't think it belongs to a particular group of people like academics. And I think there is a role for making counter suggestions, for saying that, hang on, guys, things may not be quite the way they are, and what or the way they seem. And what I discovered was that this leads to a furious reaction, as though you've disturbed a hornet's nest amongst the tight-knit academic community who claim to be the sole representatives and interpreters of human history to us, and that they then swarm upon you in fury from all over the world and attack you in every underhand way that they possibly can. So I ended up for quite a while, rather than really advancing new ideas, which I wanted to do, fighting with these incredibly boring guys, and they mainly are guys, you know. And so it becomes a sort of male ego fest, which I really detested. So I actually made a decision in this book, in Supernatural, that I was going to focus on an area that even the mainstream academics agree is truly weird, and that there are very, very strange things about it. And I was then going to go into that area in ways that they themselves did not necessarily go. And so in Supernatural, I don't look at the possibility that there might be 2 million-year-old anatomically human beings, anatomically modern human beings on the planet. I don't look, as Michael does, at the evidence that there might have been even high technologies in that period. What I look at is an accepted a mystery, that there's this extraordinary moment in human prehistory, and no academic will deny it, when a light is switched on and our ancestors transform their behavior almost literally overnight. And what could have led to that? And I found that there is, even in mainstream academia, there is a growing awareness that there was something very, very odd about this. And I found the work of Professor David Lewis Williams, who's professor of archaeology at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, for 20 years, really from the mid-80s through until past the year 2000, he conscientiously and vigorously advocated an alternative point of view as to what it was that switched our ancestors on 40-odd thousand years ago. And gradually, because his arguments are so thorough and his field research is so beautifully documented, more and more of the mainstream academic community came round to his point of view. And this point of view, which is central to my argument in Supernatural, I would say now is almost universally accepted by mainstream academics. What they don't accept are the onward implications of that point of view. And to cut a long story short, that point of view is that our ancestors created these extraordinary cave paintings and manifested this amazing quantum leap forward in their overall behavior as beings because they had experienced altered states of consciousness, that they had encountered psychedelic plants, and that they had begun to use these systematically, their shamans had begun to use them systematically to enter alternative states of consciousness, and that in those states of consciousness they experienced visions and encounters with entities and beings, which they then, when they returned to a normal state of consciousness, depicted. The earliest documents of human history, they depicted on the walls of the painted caves, and thus they document their encounters with their beings. Now, this is where thus far and no further do I go with the mainstream academics, because they then stop and say, oh, well, of course the art was majestic, and of course there was a fantastic leap forward in human behavior, but they were just having hallucinations, and there's no real fundamental meaning to this. And where I ended up taking this, because the evidence drove me there, is that these experiences that we call hallucinations in our culture, and that the shamans of hunter-gatherer societies still surviving all around the world call visions, that these visions are not unreal, that they are a retuning of the receiver wavelength of the human brain to allow us to see other realities that surround us and interpenetrate us at all times, but which in a normal, alert, problem-solving state of consciousness, we cannot normally access. And in a way, this is a criticism that I have of mainstream science in general, which is that it's very state-specific. Everything that our science does is predicated on the notion that one particular state of human consciousness, the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that we find useful to function in business and the military and commerce in the modern world, that this is really the only state of consciousness and that there are no other valid states of consciousness. Right. And thus our science refuses to investigate other states of consciousness. In fact, perversely, or perhaps not perversely,
it is very narrow, isn't it?
It's extremely narrow, and actually not only do they not investigate the vast range of human consciousness, not only do they not investigate it, but they've actually, in collaboration with governments, made it pretty much illegal to investigate it. There you may not go, they say. And actually they send you to prison if you do go there. So it becomes very difficult to investigate this. So we have this incredible creature ourselves, with a vast range of consciousness, really, truly, truly immense. And we have decided that we are really only interested in a tiny, narrow sliver of that vast range of potential, and that we will focus only on that, and that all our experimental methods and all our so-called scientific approach will be based on the notion that that is the only valid form of human consciousness. And as a result, we rule out almost the entire range of human potential in our investigations. So no wonder, in my opinion, modern science, while achieving great things in the narrow material band, is so screwed up and leads us to so many problems.
Graham, why do we need the mood-altering substances in order to reach that state of consciousness? Why can't we do it without it?
Some of us don't need the mood altering substances or the consciousness altering substances, but many of us do. There's a Puritan streak in our society which regards taking anything, any substance, any plant to change our consciousness as fundamentally wrong. But I think we have to accept that that streak is rooted in a particular history and a story of history that we have had, and that it may not be valid. After all, our brains are bioelectrochemical devices. Everything that we experience is experienced through the chemistry of our brains. I mean, go try and have an experience without any neurotransmitters. I guarantee you won't have any. So we can't object in principle to the notion that chemicals and substances are fundamental to how we experience reality. It's just illogical to object to that when we actually look at brain chemistry. Chemicals are fundamental to our experience of reality, and therefore we should hesitate before we automatically, robotically, like automata, accept the Puritan notions that have been stuffed down our throats from the 17th century. We should hesitate before we fully accept those and consider the possibilities that since all our experiences are mediated by neurochemicals, it may be interested to explore the range of experiences by altering the neurochemical balance of the brain, specifically and deliberately, as shamans have done for tens of thousands of years, using plants that have co-evolved with us on this planet. I think we need to rid ourselves of that knee-jerk puritanical reaction, which frankly is not thought through and is not based on any logic. And here's the thing. We are physical beings for sure. My own personal belief is that we are spiritual beings in essence, immersed in a physical form, rather as a man wears a suit. In order to live and survive and thrive in the physical world, we have to be connected to that physical world. It's very important that we understand the laws of physics in this physical realm, and that we function. And in fact, our day-to-day survival depends on us being able to function in this physical realm. But the fact that being the case, it leads us to exclude all other kinds of consciousness.
Let's pick it up from there, Graham, when we come right back. Graham Hancock, our special guest tonight. Wow, we'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Graham Hancock, our special guest tonight. Graham, you also talk in Supernatural about the case of spirits and aliens and fairies, that they could all be one and the same. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, this is coming to the same thing. In fact, if I could just pick you up for a moment,
sure.
on what we were
saying. I'm a little heavy.
At the end, at the end of the last segment, we were talking about altered states of consciousness and substances, and I was making the case that as physical beings with a spiritual essence, all our experiences of the world and of reality are mediated through our brains, and brains have chemistry, and it's impossible to have experiences without neurochemistry, so we can't... in principle, object to the notion that experiences that can perhaps be enhanced, or that it's possible to peer into different areas of reality by altering our brain chemistry, by changing the receiver wavelength of the brain. And some people, and scientific evidence is that it's around about 2% of every human population, have the ability to do this absolutely spontaneously. They can alter their state of consciousness, sometimes at will, and sometimes it just happens to them without them knowing why they're doing it. And the intriguing thing is that a brain chemical, which is also a Schedule 1 hallucinogen, is implicated in this. And that brain chemical is DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which all of us have in our bodies, even though it is a Schedule 1 drug, the consumption of which can send us to jail for many years. It's actually produced in the pineal gland. In the brain. And the suggestion is that spontaneous visionaries are people who automatically, without taking any substance, overproduce. Their pineal gland goes into a period of hyperactivity. They overproduce dimethyltryptamine, and they enter into a DMT trance and have experiences in those trance. And then we come back to the standard scientific model, which says that all such experiences must inevitably be unreal, because they are not experienced in the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness that our society so sickeningly admires above all other states of consciousness. And yet, the fact that our brains produce this chemical, dimethyltryptamine, and have done so for a very long time, tells us that it must have some function or some part in mm-hmm. our lives. And therefore, what would be the objection in principle, since we understand that it's a natural product of the human brain, what would be the objection in principle to increasing the amount deliberately, intently, with intention, in order to see what experiences we have?
Maybe they don't want us to see this.
Well, I believe absolutely, George, that they don't want us to see. And I think that the whole very cleverly structured so-called war on drugs, which is financed with billions and billions of dollars of our own money, probably came about because of those CIA and other secret agency mind control experiments that were done in the 60s, the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, often with volunteers who didn't even know what was being done to them, who were given high-powered hallucinogens. I suspect that our masters in this society of ours learned something during those experiments that told them that if everybody had these experiences, which was becoming possible in the climate of the 60s, if everybody had these experiences, then their grip on our hearts and minds might be broken forever. And I think it would be blown away. And I think the decision was taken very deliberately then to engage in a massive mind control exercise, which was intended to stop the average citizen from ever being able to have such experiences, which might shake their view of the whole nature of reality and pluck away their loyalty from the military-industrial state, which is what our societies basically are today. So actually, yes, I do think there is a conspiracy here. I think the CIA and other agencies learned something back in the 50s, 60s through to the early 70s when they were doing these experiments. And I think I think it scared them. And they decided that their grip on society would be fatally weakened if they allowed this to proceed. And the whole war on drugs, I think, comes from that. I think it's filled with lies and propaganda and misinformation, but it has become so rooted into people's patterns of thought and indeed so rooted into the language itself, such that we cannot use the word drug without coupling it with the word abuse. The notion that there might be responsible, adult, mature use of drugs is ruled out by the very notion of drug abuse, which is always connected to the word drug. And this is rather like Orwellian language in 1984, where the language itself is turned against the citizen so that it becomes impossible for the citizen to think independently because the language is being constructed by the powers that be. So I do think that there is a huge issue underlying this, which is the issue of individual freedom and individual liberty. And it always saddens and faintly horrifies me that good Republican Americans, for the most part, Republicans, I have Democrats too, but let's talk about the Republicans, who passionately believe in the freedom of the individual adult and who believe in adult responsibility, indeed who believe in it so much that they militantly feel it is the right of every adult to own a gun, because they rightly point out that it is not the gun which is the evil thing, but it's the misuse of the gun by certain individuals, and therefore responsible individuals should not be denied the right to bear weapons. Indeed, it's protected in the American Constitution. The very same individuals who think that are also the people who most vigorously persecute drug users. Now, let's just pause and think about what is involved with, for example, the use of hallucinogens like dimethyltryptamine and LSD. This concerns the consciousness of the individual. If you consider what is a human being, what is the most important, the most significant part of the human being? Certainly not his arms and legs or his stomach or her stomach, his or her. It is the consciousness of the individual. It is our consciousness that makes us human.
It's the soul of that person.
It's the soul of that person. And yet we live in a society which tells us that it is illegal, that we are evil, depraved individuals, that we must be sent to prison sometimes for up to 30 years if we as adults responsibly, in the privacy of our own homes, doing no harm to others, choose to explore our own consciousness. And I think it's a Republican duty, frankly, if the Republican Party genuinely believes in the freedom of the individual, then they must protect the individual's freedom of consciousness. I'm not saying freedom of conscience, although they must protect that as well. I'm saying freedom of consciousness. And therefore, to be a true Republican, I believe it is necessary for Republicans to advocate and defend the right of adults responsibly to explore their own consciousness with plants and substances that have co-evolved with us on this planet for millions of years. And it creates an extraordinary contradiction if the Republican Party does not do that, and yet it doesn't do that, because there's this knee-jerk puritanism coupled with the misinformation of the war on drugs. Now, of course, there may be a downside. There may be damage. There is, of course, a damage to guns. Many people get killed every year by guns, but the fundamental principle that responsible adults should not be restricted in that area by the state, and that they should only be punished if they then behave irresponsibly, that should also apply to consciousness-altering substances. The adult choice to explore one's own consciousness with drugs is a choice that adults should be allowed to make in a free society. Now, if those adults then go and get in someone else's face and cause that person trouble, then the state should intervene, but not before. That's my view.
In your opinion, Graham, by getting into this altered state, what does it do to the individual? What kind of information are they going to obtain?
Most often, it does healthy and positive things. Now, I'm not speaking about addictive drugs like heroin. My own view is that all drugs should be legal. I think that
I've said that too, just to get the crime rate under control.
First and foremost, if we want to get if we want to get crime down, we've got to stop this unholy alliance between criminal gangs and our government, which has been engendered by the whole war on drugs. Half the crime in our society is caused by this problem, and it would go away overnight if government would simply legalize these substances and control and regulate them in the same way that we do with alcohol.
Yes.
We've had the experience. We saw it in prohibition in the United States back at the early part of the 20th century. It just doesn't work. It causes crime. Are we brain dead? Don't we realize that? It causes crime. And the war on drugs is causing half the crime in our society. The answer is not more and more draconian penalties, not more and more billions of dollars given to armed state agencies to invade the privacy of our own consciousness. The answer is to make all these substances legal and to regulate them and control them. Overnight, you would get rid of all the drug gangs. We would have no more drug crime. Overnight, you would get rid of the dangers of badly cut and prepared street drugs, which cause so many deaths. You would have quality. I do not think you would see a vast increase in drug taking. Most people would still choose not to do it.
Yep.
But those who do it would no longer, for exploring their own consciousness responsibly as adults, would no longer face these heinous prison sentences.
And look what you do to the cartels.
And you destroy the cartels overnight. They suddenly, without a market, they have no market at all because, of course, regulated and controlled through government, these substances can be made available at a price that will, it's simple economics. They'll undercut the cartels. They'll have higher quality and lower price. Overnight, the cartels are out of business. They can't do that anymore. And there's no more drug wars. Everything, all that horrible miasma of awful human behavior where we are willingly handing over our young people to the worst people on the planet would be gone. And instead, hopefully, wise advice through our society, friendly advice, not advice backed up by vicious draconian punishments, but friendly advice that we understand and accept would be available to us. And the classic example of this, I realize we're getting far from our topic.
Yeah, let's come back real soon.
We'll come back to it. But the classic example is tobacco. Look at the vast fall in the consumption of tobacco over the last 20 years. That's happened because people have been given good, honest information about tobacco, which they have believed, and they've made the rational decision as adults to stop smoking cigarettes. That's what we need to do with drugs. If drugs are truly harmful, let's give them the information and let's trust adults to realize that the way they've done that with tobacco. Tobacco was never illegal. Smoking cigarettes was never punished by 30 years in prison. And yet the consumption of tobacco has fallen. On the other hand, the consumption of all hard drugs has vastly increased in the last 40 years. Therefore, any logical person can see that the present policy isn't working and we need a change of direction. And philosophically, if we respect the integrity and the sovereignty of the adult, then we have to respect the adult's right to explore his or her own consciousness. Because if I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I'm not sovereign over anything. And it's a waste of time to talk about freedom. It's a total waste of time to talk about it. So there's my rant over, George. Let's get back to the subject.
And what is there in the consciousness that they want us to hide?
I think that they want us focused on a very narrow strip of reality, which relates to production and consumption, to turn us into robotic machines in the prevailing state system, which they so highly value. And yet, when we look at the ruin of the world around us today, it's all caused by people who are absolutely focused on that state, on the alert problem-solving state of consciousness and no other state of consciousness. I think there are vast realms of experience out there. Here's where we interface with quantum physics. Here's where we interface with the notion of parallel dimensions. And honestly, if I were to put money on it, I would bet that the UFO abduction phenomenon and its connection, because you raised this a moment ago, with fairies and with spirits that shamans encounter, that all of this is about the possible range of human experience. And most of us, most of the time, don't encounter so-called aliens or spirits or fairies because our consciousness is narrowly focused into the alert problem-solving mentality. But if we allow our consciousness to expand, if we consider the brain itself as an instrument with which we study reality, you know, we're used to the idea of telescopes and microscopes. We will increase our ability to peer into the minuscule realm with microscopes, and we'll increase our ability to peer into the vast distances of space with telescopes. And we're quite used to enhancing our senses with mechanical devices. But what people have not thought through yet is that there may be an extraordinary way to enhance our senses by adjusting the receiver wavelength of the brain. And that, in my view, is what happens in altered states of consciousness. So the experiences we have in those states of consciousness are not illusions and you know, your brain on drugs. What those experiences actually are like applying a lens to the brain and allowing us to see more of reality than we normally see. And I think the powers that be don't want us to see more of reality in that way.
You've talked about the ancients depicting, let's say, these aliens, and they all seem very similar, which tells me then they're all experiencing the same thing. They're all seeing the same creatures.
Exactly.
Is it a physical visitation as well, or is it strictly in its consciousness?
No, I think that both things go on. I think we're dealing with the intelligent inhabitants of other dimensions, who perhaps have this is where I would go if you ask me what I think this phenomenon is about. I think it's an interdimensional phenomenon, and I think there's a physical element to that. It may well be that the inhabitants of other dimensions have found ways to physically penetrate different dimensions, of which ours might be one. Perhaps that's what the flying saucer is. Perhaps it's a device to break through the veil between worlds. Rather than a device to carry us across interstellar space,
right.
See, this is where I find the UFO, where I find myself at odds with the UFO lobby, because although the UFO lobby is demanding disclosure from government,
yes,
most of the UFO lobby is very much as state-specific as government is. That they want to see this problem purely in nuts and bolts physical terms. That we see these flying objects in the sky, we are abducted by these beings in one way or another, and that therefore this must be beings from distant parts of this physical universe.
Right.
There is no reason why that should be the case. We have a phenomenon here.
It's easier to comprehend, I think. Right?
It seems
Isn't
to be
it?
Easier to comprehend, but the evidence to me suggests that the problem is more complicated than that, and that we may be dealing with other inhabitants from this physical universe, but it's more likely that at least we're also dealing with inhabitants of other dimensions, and that this is why they become the phenomenon is so hard to pin down in mainstream scientific terms. Because mainstream science is state-specific, and we need to alter our state of consciousness in order to properly explore these experiences. And this is why, in Supernatural, I devote quite a lot of the book, a few chapters, to exploring the work of Dr. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico, and the extraordinary experiences that his volunteers had under the influence of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, the first federally approved program to give DMT to human volunteers, was undertaken by Rick Strassman in the 1990s. And the information that came out of that study was so mind-blowingly extraordinary and cast such a new and different light on the alien abduction phenomenon that I don't think anybody who claims to be interested in UFOs and alien abductions should ignore it. They have to take it into account. It should be regarded, this area of exploration should be regarded as an additional weapon in our armory for exploring the UFO mystery.
It is fascinating, Graham, how so many experts in the field of ufology begin to change from believing that they were exclusively physical to more dimensional, like you're beginning to say. Let's talk about that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Graham Hancock, on one end, I want to believe that there is a physical UFO presence, that there are extraterrestrials on other planets throughout this galaxy, for example, in this universe, and that they have advanced themselves beyond us. They have learned a propulsion system. They've learned how to bend space and time, and they're coming here. To me, that's kind of romantic. Yet the dimensional theory, which is growing now, is, you know, especially when you talk to physicists like Michio Kaku, who talk about the parallel universes now, I guess it's very possible that that's where they're coming from.
I do personally think that that's what's going on, and I do think that there is a physical element to it, that it isn't only confined to the realm of consciousness. And it may be, indeed, also on top of that, that we are having visitations from other physical beings like us in this physical universe who've just mastered interstellar propulsion. I'm not ruling that out. I'm just saying that I think we ought to widen the investigation to explore these other possibilities, which may not be mutually exclusive. They may all work together. There is no doubt that there is a physical aspect to the UFO abduction phenomenon. I mean, to speak only of Dr. Lear's work, which we both, you know Dr. Lear very well, but yes. his work at the X conference and these implants that are taken out of people's bodies, I mean, those, you know, which consist of, my goodness, meteoritic iron, you know, this is certainly a physical element. And for sure, sometimes UFOs, as well as being visual, show up on radar screens. There are radar traces. So there is undoubtedly a physical element to this, but I think we shouldn't leap to the conclusion, because that is so, that therefore it means we are dealing with beings basically like us who've just traveled a very long way to get here. Maybe the long way they've traveled has actually been across the boundaries between dimensions, and maybe they've created physical devices to enable them not only to project their consciousness from one dimension to another, but to project themselves physically in some way. I think I'm totally open to that, and I think that is definitely going on. And that's why you brought it up earlier, and I kind of led us on a bit of a diversion, but this issue of aliens, fairies, and spirits, which I explore at length in Supernatural, is a very, very important issue, I think, to understanding this phenomenon. Right now, today, in the Amazon, in Central Africa, and in other parts of the world where you have hunter-gatherer societies still existing, they have shamans, and those shamans, the universal characteristic of shamanism around the world is the targeted, deliberate use of altered states of consciousness. And there are many ways to put ourselves into altered states of consciousness. It can be rhythmic dance, as in the case of the Bushmen of the Kalahari. They do a trance dance, as they call it, around a fire for up to 24 hours without stopping.
That would put you in a trance.
Absolutely. And they experience their spirits leaving their bodies and entering another realm where they encounter what they construe as spirits, which teach them vital knowledge. Those spirits have certain very definite characteristics when they're described. Now let's jump to another phenomenon, the phenomenon that was common in Europe roughly from 1,000 years ago until it began to peter out in the 1940s and 50s, and this was the phenomenon of encounters with beings that Europeans used to call fairies or elves. Very often you would see the fairies dancing in a circle. If you were to go to that circle and put your hand to touch the movement, you would be drawn into it, and you would then be carried away into another world where you would encounter the beings who you construed as fairies and elves. And again, they had very definite, specific characteristics that were described. And quite often you would feel that you'd been with them for an hour or two, and they would then return you to your world, and you would discover that vast time had passed. In some cases, 300 years had passed. There are stories of people who entered a fairy circle and came out 300 years later thinking that it was the same afternoon, and discovered that their disappearance was a subject of legend in the village that they had come from. Bit familiar, isn't it, with the missing time phenomenon, with alien abductions today, except the so-called aliens appear to be more merciful that they don't give us 300 years of missing time. They give us 3 or 4 hours of missing time so that we can reconnect to our world. In short, I'm suggesting that the fairy dance and the flying saucer are both technologies. Perhaps in the other dimensions, the technology evolves as well. But they're both doing the same thing. They're abducting us into another realm, another state of reality. And so finally, we do come to the modern form of this phenomenon. I believe they're all the same phenomenon seen through different cultural spectacles. The modern form is what we call alien abductions. And again, very specific characteristics are ascribed to the aliens by the people who construe them as such and who have these experiences. And let's just examine these common characteristics, and I do this at length in Supernatural, which unite these three supposedly different realms of fairies, spirits, and aliens. Very often, the alien abductee will appear, abductor will appear to the abductee first in the form of an animal. John Mack's work at the University of Harvard, which I know you're deeply familiar with, documents thousands of abduction encounters. And in vast numbers of them, and John draws attention to this himself, the late, wonderful John Mack, so I'm so sorry that he's not with us anymore.
Tragic
loss of a great, great human being. What he documents is that very often the alien who later transforms into a typical gray first appears in the form of an animal, or like a wolf or a deer or a bird, typically an owl. Owls are very often seen. Or in the form of a therianthrope. Now, that's a Greek word. It comes from therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man. In other words, a hybrid who is part human and part animal in form, and then later may transform into the form of the gray with the broad forehead and narrow pointed chin and large dark eyes. But very often the being is first encountered as an animal or as a therianthrope. This is identical with fairies. If you go back to the Middle Ages and look at the accounts of fairy abductions, they very often first encounter the fairy in an animal or in a therianthrope, a beast man form. And then he later transforms into, you know, the fairy form, which is, again, this high, broad forehead, narrow pointed chin, large dark eyes that we call grays today.
Right.
And lo and behold, it's the same with the spirits that shamans are encountering in the jungles of Brazil today, that they appear in animal or therianthropic form and later transform into the form that we would recognize as grays. And what I'm suggesting is that in all these different experiences, it's actually the same experience that is being had, and it's being construed through different cultural frameworks. We, as beings, it's impossible for us to see or experience anything without interpreting it at the same time. Interpretation is built into human perception from the get-go, and inevitably we will interpret what we experience within the framework of our culture and our society. Our culture and our society today is in the business of exploring outer space, so we construe these experiences as visitors from outer space, otherwise just like us. In the past, it was fairies, and in hunter-gatherer societies, it's spirits. That's how they construe them, but I'm suggesting that the underlying reality, and there is a reality that underlies this, is one and the same.
Yeah, some even said they came from the sea.
And some say they come from the sea, yes, absolutely. And then, in fact, there are UFO abductees who report being taken down under the sea into great caverns beneath the sea, a very familiar experience to shamans. In the Amazon, for example, shamans often believe that they are abducted down beneath the waters of the Amazon River, where they come to an extraordinary city of crystal towers and gigantic ziggurats. That is called Encante, the enchanted city that lies beneath the waters of the Amazon. All these experiences are made possible by altered states of consciousness, but I don't believe they are artifacts of altered states of consciousness. I believe they're real experiences that can only be accessed in an altered state of consciousness. And this is why Rick Strassman's work, which I mentioned earlier, at the University of New Mexico is so important, because his and he has published this in a book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. He was the first scientist for more than 20 years to be given permission by the federal government to work with human volunteers on a Schedule 1 substance, in this case dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which, as I also mentioned earlier, is produced in the human brain. And Rick was adding to the amount of DMT in his volunteers' bodies by giving them DMT on a hospital bed at the University of New Mexico. And in the 20-minute DMT trip that is typical with DMT, his volunteers reported extraordinary experiences. The volunteers were not comparing notes, but many of them reported meeting the same beings.
Isn't that incredible?
It's absolutely extraordinary. Who had the same teachings to give them. And in about 80% of the cases, these experiences were indistinguishable from the experiences that are reported by UFO abductees, including being taken up to a spaceship in the sky, having implants put in one's body, having probes put into one's brain, crystal inserted into the brain. All of the experiences that are common for UFO abductees, meeting beings that first appeared as animals or as part animal, part human creatures, all of these experiences, and typically the greys, were reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers lying on hospital beds at the University of New Mexico. We know that they were not physically abducted, but their consciousness, I'm suggesting, was abducted. And that does not rule out the physical element to this experience, but it helps us to understand the elusive and curious nature of the experience, that it's necessary to be in a particular state of consciousness in order to have that experience. And Rick's suggestion, and he did explore this with John Mack, they were just beginning to work on it together when John Mack was tragically killed.
By a drunk driver.
By a drunk driver. Rick's suggestion is that the people who have the UFO abduction experience are people who spontaneously overproduce DMT in the brain. That their pineal gland, and let's not forget that the pineal gland is a sense organ. It's called the third eye. In evolutionary older animals like lizards and reptiles, it still actually is sensitive to light. In human beings, it's gone deeper into the brain, but the suggestion is that it's still a sense organ, which allows us to sense other dimensions, and the lens through which it allows us to do this is the DMT that is produced in the pineal gland. So his suggestion was that all of us produce DMT in our pineal glands, most of us in sub-trance levels. That the UFO abductee is an individual who spontaneously overproduces it, is plunged into this trance-like state, has these experiences, and crucially, that is not to say that the experiences are not real.
So there could be a science behind this, Graham.
I believe there's a science behind this. And unfortunately, our society, at least officially, is very reluctant to explore that science, and not only reluctant, but actually condemns it and witch hunts it and turns it into a criminal act. And I think we're making a huge mistake by doing that, because there's a fertile area of inquiry into the nature of reality and into the nature of what we are as beings, which we're simply not getting into at the level we should be getting into because of fear and narrowness of mind, and I suspect an intention on the part of small groups of powerful individuals to monopolize and control this aspect of human experience, which is a very old and very important aspect of human experience, and which has been demonstrated from what happened with the painted caves and that transformation in human behavior about 40,000 years ago, which has been demonstrated is of fundamental importance to the human race, which set us on the track that led to the modern world. And in a way, I think what's happening is that we modern humans are in danger of becoming locked once again into rigid and unthinking patterns of behavior. Just as our ancestors were before they started having visions and creating the paintings on the cave walls, which then opened their minds and made them much broader creatures, we've become, our particular lock-in is to technology, to the mechanical fix, to mechanical advantage. It's very successful, works incredibly well, but we've hoodwinked ourselves into the illusion that that's the only way forward for us. And we've deliberately, willfully cut off the exploration of consciousness that was so fundamental in the great leap forward of our ancestors. And I'm afraid we're going to get locked again into a rigid and destructive pattern of behavior unless we're prepared to open up to that exploration of consciousness and regard these sacred plants as allies in that exploration rather than as enemies.
What does this tell you about all these civilizations, past and present, that seem to say the same thing about what they see when they're in this higher state of consciousness?
It tells us that it's a wonderful mystery to be born as a human being and to be born in a human body, to be a creature that is part spirit and part matter, to be born into this strange and mysterious existence where to go through it, every moment of it, if we only open ourselves up to it, is an adventure in discovery and in self-discovery, where mysteries surround us at every corner, and where it's our mission to explore mystery rather than to shut ourselves off from mystery. That's what it tells me.
That is something. I want to talk with you when we come back about Fingerprints of the Gods.
Absolutely.
Where do we get Supernatural?
Supernatural is available in all the shops, and it's available on Amazon.com. Graham Hancock, Supernatural.
Controversial when you wrote this?
Yes, controversial. But controversial, I think, in a different way from my previous books, precisely because it does inevitably deal with altered states of consciousness. And this is one of the great taboos, perhaps the last great taboo in our society, the thing that we cannot talk about anymore. The moment you start talking about deliberately altering people's state of consciousness, it raises a huge knee-jerk reaction that's been conditioned into us from birth, of hostility and anger and puritanism and the feeling that it must somehow be wrong to deliberately alter our consciousness with a plant or with a substance. And so I found myself, surprisingly, you know, having to defend our right as individuals to explore our own consciousness. And this is a controversial issue. Weirdly, I don't understand why it should be controversial, but it is. It's terribly controversial to say that we as adults have a right to explore our own consciousness in any way we wish, so long as we don't get in other people's faces.
I do believe Jacques Vallée, who, of course, the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was generated around, has also moved into the direction of dimensional.
Oh, yes. Jacques Vallée's work, which I cite at length in Supernatural, is really the most majestic and wonderful opening of minds. Passport to Magonia, written by Jacques Vallée, was the first book to explore the connection between fairies and aliens. And really what I've done in Supernatural, he stopped that in 1969, is I've taken the evidence forward from where Jacques Vallée stopped in 1969 to all the new evidence on UFO abductions and indeed on shamanic experiences that has come into the public domain since 1969. But Jacques Vallée's work in this field is absolutely fundamental. He was the guy who made the real breakthrough, who saw that fairies and aliens are not different things, but the same things seen through different framework.
Truly remarkable work on his part, and Graham, of course, always with you. The parallels also between Supernatural, Fingerprints of the Gods, also, they run hand in hand. Did your views change at all over the years?
Well, no, not really, because in one area, I found that my new discoveries while researching Supernatural added to what I had learned going back to the early 1990s and researching Fingerprints of the Gods. I mean, look at ancient Egypt. You know, look at all the deities of ancient Egypt, whether it's Anubis, whether it's the Sphinx, whether it's Sekhmet, whether it's Sobek, who's got the head of a crocodile and the body of a human being. All of the ancient Egyptian deities are these therianthropes, part animal, part human hybrids. And we now know from Rick Strassman's work, from the experiences of shamans, that such encounters are common only in altered states of consciousness. Therefore, the ancient Egyptians, too, were definitely using altered states of consciousness.
Up next, some updates from Graham Hancock, Fingerprints of the Gods. Almost hard to believe, Graham, sign and the seal, when you wrote that about the lost Ark of the Covenant 16 years ago.
I know. It's really strange. I find myself really puzzled by that, because it just seems like yesterday in the course of my life. You know, during the 70s and 80s, I'm getting to be an old boy now. I'm 58 years old.
Oh, don't say that, because that's how old I am.
Well, there we are, George. Another thing in common.
Uh-huh.
So I became a journalist after leaving university in 1973, and I quickly became very, very focused on Africa and specialized in Africa. I lived in Somalia for a year. I lived in Kenya as the East Africa correspondent of The Economist.
And in that
role, I was traveling around the East African region, reporting on events and developments there. And my travels took me regularly to Ethiopia, which has a common border with Kenya, just north of Kenya, in the Horn of Africa. And because Ethiopia, of course, was very much in the news in the early 1980s with famines and wars and all sorts of terrible things happening. In the course of my duties as a reporter in the middle of a war zone, I was flown in on a DC-3. We had to do one of these strange descents where you dive down from high altitude and more or less nosedive into the airfield, because the whole city, it was an ancient city called Aksum in northern Ethiopia, was surrounded by rebel forces. And so flew into Aksum in this hair-raising dive on a plane that the day before, it was still bloodstained. It had been used to carry wounded from a battlefield. Flew in there. The city at that point was still in government hands to report on what was happening there. And while I was there, I went to the Cathedral of St. Mary of Zion, which stands in the heart of Aksum. Aksum's a very mysterious place. It's been a Christian city for more than 1,700 years. It converted to Christianity around 300 AD. But before that, there was an extraordinary religion there, which was based very much on Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also amazing megalithic constructions, huge obelisks that almost nobody has heard of in the city of Aksum, one of them weighing more than 500 tons and standing 110 feet tall. I suddenly found that I went there for a news story, but I was in the middle of this historical mystery. And there in a little chapel in the grounds of the cathedral, the ancient cathedral of St. Mary of Zion, I met an elderly monk who claimed to be the guardian of the lost Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was something very powerful about this guy. And I asked him he had cataracts in his eyes. His eyes were covered in milky cataracts. Very old man. He'd been the guardian of the Ark only for 4 or 5 years at that point. And he said that, I asked him, what is the Ark? And he said, the Ark is a thing of fire. Look what it's done to my eyes. And suddenly I was hooked. This was something I had to know more about. And I began to investigate it, getting away from my concerns as a reporter on wars and famines and economy, and looking at historical mysteries. For the first time, it was in effect my initiation into historical mysteries. And I discovered indeed that Ethiopia claims to possess the lost Ark of the Covenant, that it is fundamental to Christianity in Ethiopia. This is very odd, but because the Ark is not a Christian object. It's a pre-Christian object associated with Moses, but of course part of the Christian tradition. They claim to possess it. They claim that it is kept in this sanctuary chapel in the city of Aksum. Every church in Ethiopia, there's more than 20,000 of them, has to have a replica or a copy of the Ark of the Covenant in its Holy of Holies. Otherwise, it ceases to be a church. It's deconsecrated. So clearly, this ancient Judaic element was very important in the almost equally ancient Christianity of Ethiopia. And I decided I was going to explore this subject. Hey, could it be true? Could these guys actually have the Lost Ark of the Covenant? After all, it's the only country in the world which has a living tradition of veneration and worship surrounding the Ark of the Covenant. And over the next few years, more or less as a hobby in the background, I began to assemble evidence which more and more supported the Ethiopian claim and led me to the suggestion that the Ark of the Covenant is indeed in Ethiopia, but that it came there by a different route than the one that is accounted for in Ethiopian myth and tradition, that the myth and tradition was an overlay on an earlier historical event. And finally, right about 1989, I suddenly realized that I had enough material to really explore the possibility of doing a book on this, and I then focused myself totally for the next 2 years on finishing that off and doing the final journey to Aksum with my which took place during the height of the civil war in Ethiopia, and I had to travel in from the Sudan across deserts up through mountains, a journey of 5 days, sheltering in under trees during the day because the Ethiopian Air Force was flying overhead, strafing anything that moved on the roads, and finally getting to the city of Aksum, which by then was in rebel hands, and again going back to the sanctuary chapel, and again meeting the guardian, who by then, the previous guardian had died, and a new guardian was in place, and lo and behold, he also had cataracts over his eyes. There was never any question that I would be allowed into the Holy of Holies to see the Ark itself. The whole of Aksum is an armed camp, and remains so until this day. But I was allowed to go as far as the gates of the chapel. And you know, oddly, my gung-ho journalistic instincts to somehow force my way past and break in were discouraged not only by the men with guns, but also by the feeling of the sanctity and holiness of this object. And that in a sense, I wasn't good enough to be allowed in there. That there's some special quality of the human being who guards this object and who is the only individual who is allowed to go into its presence. So I ended up writing the book, The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, which does support the Ethiopian claim, but also goes into many other highways and byways, including the Knights Templar, who I believe did go to Ethiopia in the 12th century in search of the Ark of the Covenant.
That's a great story. Now, Fingerprints of the Gods, where you talked about a lost great civilization.
Yes.
How great was that civilization?
Well, I was led into Fingerprints of the Gods while researching The Sign and the Seal, because there are certain aspects of the Ark of the Covenant. If you go into all the ancient traditions, there's masses of material in the Bible itself, but there's also wonderful material on the Ark of the Covenant in Jewish legends. Really extraordinary additional information on this object. And when you assemble all this information together, as I did in The Sign and the Seal, you find that you're dealing with an object that sounds almost as much like a piece of technology as it does sound like a radio for talking to God. And when I use the phrase radio for talking to God, of course, that's how it was described in the Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. And indeed, Moses did use the Ark of the Covenant to talk to God. He would go into its presence and hear the voice of God coming from the Ark, and he would speak to God. There was something about it, the way that it was used as an instrument of war when the Israelites were conquering the Promised Land. The Ark of the Covenant was carried before them. It was the Ark carried around the walls of Jericho that led to the falling down of those walls. Not so much the trumpets, but the fact that the Ark of the Covenant was carried around 7 times. It sounded like a piece of technology, and this opened my mind to the possibility that there might have been a forgotten episode in human history, and perhaps that some of the mysteries of the Ark could be explained by the heritage of a lost civilization. And therefore, when I finished The Sign and the Seal, I decided that that would be my next inquiry. Could there have been a huge forgotten episode of a technological culture in human prehistory? Perhaps a culture very different from our own. Perhaps technology didn't occupy the same place in that society as it does in ours, but nevertheless, an advanced, lost civilization. And so what I did really in Fingerprints of the Gods was to reopen this issue. I was not the first person to explore the issue of a lost civilization, but I reopened it in the light of a quanta of stunning new information that came into the public domain during the early 1990s. And I speak here particularly of two researchers, or rather three. On the one hand, there's John Anthony West and Professor Robert Schock, professor of geology at the University of Boston, who in the early 1990s, just when I was beginning to research this book, had put forward a really compelling case that the Great Sphinx of Giza in Egypt, which stands close by the pyramids, is much older than Egyptologists believe it to be. And this is well known to your listeners, that the Great Sphinx bears the marks of water, of erosion caused by exposure to thousands of years of heavy, heavy rainfall. And Robert Schock and John Anthony West have shown through the science of paleoclimatology, that such rainfall has never fallen in Giza during the historical period since the beginning of the pharaohs, that you have to go back thousands of years earlier to what's called the Neolithic subpluvial to get the kind of rainfall that could have caused the erosion on the body of the Sphinx and on the trench that surrounds the Sphinx that we see today, and that therefore, geologically, the Sphinx is thousands of years older than the historical civilization of ancient Egypt. And intriguingly, the Sphinx was created by carving out a huge horseshoe-shaped trench in the Giza Plateau, which separated the core body from the bedrock. And then all that bedrock that was removed from around the core body was cut up into huge blocks of stone, some weighing as much as 200 tons, which were then erected into vast megalithic temples on the Giza Plateau, two of them right beside the Sphinx and three others beside what would later become each of the Great Pyramids. And therefore, if the Sphinx is geologically older, then these megalithic temples are much older as well. The pyramids may be another matter, but the megalithic construction on the Giza Plateau, the argument is convincing that it's thousands of years older than ancient Egyptian civilization, and therefore, by definition, must be the work of a lost civilization, because history documents no civilization earlier.
Could it have been Atlantean, that they came to that region after Atlantis
Yes,
collapsed?
In a word, this and I do go into this in depth in Fingerprints of the Gods, because we have a group of very mysterious texts from ancient Egypt called the Edfu building texts. Now, we must assume that these texts, there's evidence within them, had existed in some written form for thousands of years before they were finally carved into the walls of the Temple of Edfu in Upper Egypt, that there was a very ancient document that was effectively copied onto the walls of that temple. And what the Edfu building texts tell us is of the time when the gods came to Egypt. In fact, this is why I call the book Fingerprints of the Gods. When the gods came to Egypt and established the sacred places where later all temples and pyramids would be built, and who brought civilization to ancient Egypt. And the story of the Edfu building texts is that those gods previously had lived upon an island, and that island had been destroyed in a gigantic flood, and that those who came to Egypt were the survivors of that flood. And this, of course, is the myth of Atlantis by any other name.
Do you believe in also, you know, Edgar Cayce? Talk about the Hall of Records.
Yes, I think Edgar Cayce is an extremely interesting phenomenon, and this brings us back slightly to the issue of altered states of consciousness, because Edgar Cayce was the sleeping prophet.
Yes.
He went into a trance state, and in that trance state, first and foremost, what he did was diagnose ailments of his patients.
And he was pretty accurate.
He was very accurate, and he was a great gifted healer, which he used the trance state to enhance. But also in these healing trances, he would start recalling past lives and speaking of memories of a time long ago. And he talked of Atlantis and of the fall of Atlantis and of how the survivors of Atlantis had settled in various parts of the world, amongst them ancient Egypt, and how they had, in ancient Egypt, beneath the left forepaw of the Sphinx, how they had created a subterranean chamber which contained their hall of records, a complete record of everything that Atlantis knew, and the whole story of Atlantis and the learning of Atlantis was stored there like a time capsule for future reference, for use by future civilizations when the time was right, when that information was needed. And Cayce envisaged an opening of the Hall of Records at a crucial juncture in human history, round about now, round about our time, in the 21st century. And this is information that I think we cannot discount. I highly value information that is attained in altered states of consciousness, and therefore I highly value Cayce's information, and I think it should be taken into account alongside all the other information provided by archaeologists and other researchers.
Graham, I haven't had an opportunity to talk with you about 2012. December 21st, 2012, Mayan calendar. Your take.
Well, again, again, this is a mystery that I went into and was forced to go into in depth in Fingerprints of the Gods, as I explored the heritage of ancient wisdom in cultures all around the world, just as ancient Egypt appeared to contain a legacy of much earlier information, so also the ancient Mayan culture of Central America contains a legacy of what looks like a technological culture, and that legacy is the Mayan calendar, which is astonishingly accurate, unbelievably precise scientific instrument, more accurate in its measure of the length of the solar year than the Gregorian calendar that we use to this day. A work of high scientific precision. And this calendar envisages time not so much as a straight line, but as a series of enormous cycles in which human civilization rises and falls. And it's just a fact that the Mayan calendar envisages the end of the present epoch of the Earth. It doesn't mean necessarily the end of the world. It doesn't even mean the end of civilization necessarily, but it means a big change is predicted by this calendar. And that change is predicted to occur on or around the 21st of December, which is the winter solstice in the year 2012, when you convert the Mayan calendar into our calendar. And my view is that we ought to take this seriously, because it comes down to us from a remarkable civilization of antiquity who were working with this fantastically precise instrument, the Mayan calendar. We should listen to what they have to say. And what they have to say is complicated and difficult to understand. Some people interpret it as gloom and doom and the end of the world as we know it. Others interpret it with equal justification as a great transformation in human consciousness that will allow us to emerge from the chrysalis of our existing society into a new way of living on the planet. And my goodness, if there was ever a time when we humans needed to find a new way of living on the planet, that time is now. So I continue to believe that there's great truth and validity in the Mayan calendar, that we are coming up to a big change. I think all of us know it in our bones. I do not think we should manifest and project the idea of a destruction, a violent destruction of the globe. I think we should consider rather the positive view that we may emerge from this change stronger and better and better equipped to be everything we can be as human beings.
Consciousness is a marvelous thing, Graham, if it's handled correctly, isn't it?
Wonderful, wonderful thing. The greatest gift that the universe has given to us as human beings, a gift that we should revere and explore with love and with wisdom. Love, that's what's needed in the world today, above everything else.
I think so. I think we'll take some phone calls with you in our final hour. Are you ready for that?
I'm ready for that, George.
Graham's website, grahamhancock.com, once again, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Just listen to some of his works, beginning in 1993. The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, Keeper of Genesis, The Mars Mystery, Fingerprints of the Gods, The New Edition, Heaven's Mirror, Underworld, The Mysterious Origins of Civilization, Lords of Poverty, and Supernatural, which we're talking about now. Graham, does it seem like you've written so many?
No, sometimes I surprise myself. Thank you for mentioning Lords of Poverty, because that was me in my journalistic role back in the mid-80s, writing a critical book about foreign aid.
I've been following you for years, Graham, for
Thank
years.
Thank you, George.
We'll be
Thank
back
you.
In a moment with phone calls with Graham Hancock next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We've got Graham Hancock. We've got your phone calls as well. Do you think that this planet will be faced with another huge catastrophe?
Yeah, I think it's. I have to say that if you look at the broad span of history, the answer to that question has to be yes. We live in a difficult cosmic environment. The orbit of the Earth around the Sun is crossed again and again by huge asteroids, Earth-crossing asteroids called Apollo objects. Some of them 10 or 20 kilometers across. Actually, if you look at a diagram of this, it's truly scary, because it seems like our little Earth is just winding its way through these massive objects that come flying at us from all directions. And sometimes we don't even notice a near miss until it's gone past. If you look at the whole issue of global warming now. That's not a new issue. But back 125,000 years ago, before the last ice age set in, we were in a period that geologists call the Eemian. There were astonishing climate fluctuations during the Eemian, much more severe than even we're experiencing now, although supposedly there was no industrial pollution at that time. You could have changes of temperature of as much as 10 degrees within a period of a decade taking place. And finally, that massive climate instability plunged the world back into the last ice age, which then lasted from 125,000 years ago, really down until 12 or 13,000 years ago, when the last ice age finally came to an end. And during the ending of the last ice age, as ice sheets that were 2 miles thick on top of New York State, for example, melted down, and huge glacial lakes poured out their contents, scarring the landscape and adding 400 feet to sea level around the world. There were multiple catastrophes then. So if you go back even further to the time of the extinction of the dinosaurs, there's been periods of mass extinctions on our planet. So we have to say that it is a normal part of life on Earth from time to time to experience periodic, probably random cataclysms, which just are part of the deal on living on a planet in the universe, that there will be these disasters. And what life has to do is it has to bounce back. It has to be flexible. It has to cope. And the story on life on our planet over the last 4 billion years has been a story of unbelievable flexibility and resilience, and the ability to not only survive a cataclysm, but to emerge from it renewed and refreshed and ready to develop in new and creative directions. So in short, the answer to your question is yes, of course we will face another cataclysm. And the real test for us as human beings is how we deal with that and how we emerge from it. Do we become another extinct species like many others on this planet, or do we ride over the disaster into a new realm that lies beyond?
Okay, let's go to the calls now. San Francisco we go, west of the Rockies. Hello, Doug. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hey, always great to talk with you, Mr. Norrie, and it's certainly an honor to talk to Mr. Hancock. He's had an enormous effect on my life in a most positive fashion, and I'd certainly like his opinion on a subject I'd love to relate to him.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. I'd love to hear from you.
Oh, fantastic. I really want to thank you first for your Underworld. I mean, it really went on to expose megalithic architecture in the Japanese Okinawan-Taiwanese island chain. Even today, the Korean and Japanese flotsam that's thrown off of their beaches from the public washes up on each other's shores. So your geological thesis of a united Korean and Japanese and Chinese peninsula during the last great epoch of deep ice is, to me, unavoidable. I don't see how anyone can deny it. And the proto-Japanese Caucasoid Jomon people, who were the progenitors of the Hairy Ainu in Hokkaido, is similar to the megalithic Mayan, who retreated from urban existence to subsistence economies later on, are possibly the people who created the sunken ruins that you mentioned. Even National Geographic Channel confirmed that they found carvings on those ruins. So anyone denying their validity just shocks me.
Yeah.
Certainly even Japanese cinema paid due homage to Daimajin, which was kind of like a pre-Japanese golem, if you will, which were megalithic sculptures of the Gikidojin, or gods of these people, who were the manifest wrath of gods, so to speak, who would walk whenever nature was threatened.
He's your research assistant here, Graham.
This is fantastic, fantastic call. I'm really, really, really pleased to hear it. Thank you for mentioning Underworld. After I finished Fingerprints of the Gods, my feeling was that I needed to take the inquiry to a new level, and it was clear that a global flood, which is what is documented at the end of the Ice Age, was part of the picture, and that's why in the mid-1990s I learned, and my wife Santa, who's a photographer, learned to scuba dive, took our lives in our hands and went exploring for underwater ruins at depths down to about 125 feet all around the world, and Indeed, a huge focus of our research was Japan, and we did hundreds of hours of diving in Japanese waters and found gigantic stone circles underwater, and of course thoroughly explored the mysterious complex at Yonaguni, the most southwestern of all the Japanese islands, and indeed went into Japanese mythology and the whole mystery of the Jomon. The fact is that there are megalithic ruins of unknown origin above water all over Japan, which most people haven't even heard of, and these ruins simply continue underwater. And when you do the geology, you find that vast areas of land were exposed before the end of the Ice Age that are now underwater. And I felt that it was necessary for me to take the inquiry to that next level. I only wish that marine archaeologists would also explore that instead of going diving always for shipwrecks, and that the funds of major marine institutions could be put a little bit into exploring the lands that were covered by rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age. I think it would bring us a whole new perspective on human prehistory.
Absolutely. Off to Indiana we go now with Andrew, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to share a kind of a theory that I had about the whole Atlanteans thing when their islands went down.
Yeah.
We were talking about how they could have possibly gone to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And Linda was on last week talking about how, you know, the Mayans were really advanced and everything. And I thought maybe also quite a few of the people might have gone to Tikal, where the Mayans were located.
Tikal in Guatemala.
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful place. I've been there. I mean, Tikal is part of the overall Mayan culture, and I think we need to recognize, first of all, that the Mayans themselves are an extraordinarily ancient civilization, and secondly, that everything they built and created was built on top of an earlier layer of civilization and culture. The archaeologists know them as the Olmecs, which take us back into the mists of prehistory, and that certainly Mayan civilization and the Mayan sacred sites were a legacy of an even earlier culture, which in turn was a legacy of an even earlier culture before that, and that's what brings us back finally to the survivors of a lost civilization at the end of the Ice Age.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's all I really had.
All right.
Thank you for that point. Have you been to Tikal yourself, by the way?
Oh, he's already gone.
Oh, right.
Maybe he's on his way there.
Maybe so. Maybe so. It's a fantastic site. Absolutely amazing.
And we're not going to Santa Fe, Texas. Lynette on the wildcard line. Hi, Lynette.
Yes, hello. I'll make this really quick. Just a couple of quick points. You know, Edgar Cayce also prognosticated his reincarnation in 2012 in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I was wondering if anyone knows if there's been any surveys done with brain-injured patients. Sometimes people claim to be psychic after a traumatic head injury.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the alpha states that are achieved by the Buddhists, you know, as an example,
mm-hmm.
seem to scare governments like China. Do you think that's maybe because they're afraid of the power of collective consciousness? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you. You've made an absolutely excellent point. Governments all around the world are deeply concerned by altered states of consciousness and absolutely want to stop us having those altered states of consciousness. And of course, visionary plants are not by any means the only way to get into altered states of consciousness. Certain meditative techniques, such as those that have been explored and elaborated by the Buddhists, will also get us into the requisite altered state of consciousness. Even rhythmic music and certain forms of dance are capable of doing this. And wherever this happens, you find that governments want to stop it. They want to prevent it happening. And to me, this is one of the greatest conspiracies of the modern age, whether it's the Chinese government suppressing the altered state techniques of the Buddhists, or whether it's the American and British governments preventing adults from exploring their own consciousness with visionary plants. The common element is that the government wants to keep control. It actually wants to keep control of our consciousness. It may pretend to us that we are free to buy this or that. We can choose one or other commercial product, but really we're not free. to explore our own consciousness. And there's a vast mind control game at work which seeks to structure human thinking according to a very narrow pattern that serves the interest of what finally will turn out to be very small, powerful interest groups in our society.
All right, next up we go to Ohio. Mike, take it away. Hi, Michael.
Good evening, George and Graham.
Hi.
George, have you ever seen John Carpenter's movie, They Live?
Yes.
Where the sunglasses let you see David Icke's reptilian people? Some suggest the sunglasses were a metaphor for the mushroom vision and therefore banned. And George, Graham is clearly Terrence McKenna's successor.
He sure Graham. Is.
Well, that's Graham. A tremendous compliment that you've just paid to me, because the late, great Terrence McKenna was one of the truly magnificent minds that has lived on this planet in recent times. A tremendous thinker, a man who was open to all kinds of possibilities that most of us are closed off to. And so I'd like to take this opportunity also to pay tribute to Terrence McKenna and to the wonderful, wonderful work that he did.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Next up, Ontario, Canada on the international line. Hello, Greg.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning to you.
My question goes back to your discussion on consciousness, and I was wondering if Mr. Hancock believes that consciousness is a phenomenon that is independent of matter, or if it's something that is tied up with the substance of our bodies.
Thank you for that question. I absolutely believe that consciousness is independent of matter. And I think that one of the great mistakes of modern science is to believe that consciousness is generated by the brain. I think this is a mistake. I think that consciousness is mediated by the brain, much in the same way that a television signal is mediated by the television set to allow us to access it. The signal is there all the time, but we need a TV set to access it. I think that's what the brain is doing. And therefore, once you accept that consciousness is the essence and that the material form is simply a kind of suit or an avatar into which consciousness is situated, then you become open to the notion that consciousness must, of course, survive death. And you understand out-of-body experiences because consciousness is not dependent on the body. It is simply immersed in the body for a particular period of time. Consciousness, I believe, is eternal. I think it's one of the forces of the universe, like gravity, and it's been with us forever, and it's what the whole universe is about, actually.
Graham, what's your theory on how they moved those huge blocks of pyramid stone?
Well, we mustn't underestimate the abilities of ancient cultures who'd been working with stone for thousands of years to do things with stone that we can't do. But really, some of their feats go beyond the physical and require us to consider. And indeed, if you look into the ancient Egyptian myths, some kind of mind control, a science that harnessed the power of the human mind to move large objects independent of physical leverage. There are beams above the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid, already 300 feet above the ground, which weigh 70 tons each and are made of solid granite. These things are vast. They're sort of room-sized beams. And it absolutely beggars belief as to how they were got into place simply using humans pulling ropes. It just, you know, anybody who's actually seen those beams cannot believe that it was done simply by mechanical advantage, that they knew something that we didn't know. And there are myths that speak of the priests singing these huge blocks into place. And we have stories amongst the Tibetans of song, of sound being used to lift blocks of stone. I think that there's a technology of consciousness that was used in the past to manipulate the physical world, which we've forgotten today.
Next up, we go to Colton, California. Hello, Joe. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hey, Mr. Norton and Graham, how are you guys doing? All right.
Good to have you with us.
Fine, thank you.
And a real quick question. I just want to know exactly what is the Ark of the Covenant, really? I just want to know, like, what is its purpose? And like, I heard about it on Indiana Jones, and you guys made a quick reference to it, but I just want to know, like, what kind of power it has, or what's the significance, or what exactly is the Ark?
Well, in the Bible, it is the home of God on earth. It is the interface between the deity and human beings.
Yep.
It's why the first temple is built in Jerusalem. David is considered not pure enough to build it, but his son Solomon is, and he builds the temple, and it is built exclusively as an house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.
Wasn't it the depository of the Ten Commandments?
And the Bible tells us that it was the depository of the Ten Commandments, and yet when you look at the properties of these stones on which the Ten Commandments were supposedly inscribed by the finger of God, you find that a radiance emerges from them, that it burns the face of Moses, that it can cause blindness, that it contains a power that energizes the ark, almost like a power plant. It's a very, very, very strange. When you simply look at the ancient accounts and take them on their own terms, you find that you're dealing with something that has a spiritual function and also, weirdly, a technological function.
Didn't they say in the Bible that if you touched it the wrong way, you could get electrocuted or you could die?
Absolutely. There's the story of Uzzah, who is in the throng surrounding the ark as David is having it carried up. It's carried on special poles, which are wood covered in gold, which is a very strong insulating property, by a group of priests, the Levites, who are specially skilled in transporting the ark. It's always wrapped in hides, in animal skins, to prevent its radiance from damaging the crowd. And in this case, the ark is on the back of a cart, and it's seen to be toppling slightly. And this individual comes out of the crowd, Uzzah, and he reaches up his hand to steady it. And as he does so, a bolt of lightning comes out from the ark and strikes him dead. He's fried and killed instantly on the spot. And actually, there's many accounts in the Bible of the ark doing this. When the Philistines grab the ark and take it away from the Israelites for a while, after about 3 weeks, they give it back because it's caused amongst them a terrible outbreak of cancerous tumors. Well, what does that remind us of, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Fascinating, Graham. Fascinating work. Let's go to Caesar in San Francisco, California. Hi, Caesar.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Mr. Hancock, yeah. You may have single-handedly explained addiction on this planet. The suppression of expressing consciousness, I feel that the politics and religion of this world have made it possible for us not explore our consciousness, which is why people look to substance abuse and things like that to explore their different consciousness and a different way of thinking.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And
sorry, I
hello?
Hello? I bumped him.
Well, just to pick up on that, on the point.
Hold it, Graham, until we come back, okay?
Okay.
We'll be back. Nice job tonight, by the way, Graham. Very informative.
Thank you, George. Thank you. I'm really enjoying it.
The last caller before the break was talking about the higher states of consciousness.
Yes.
And, you know, the difference, I think, between getting into that with, as we've talked about, the altered states of drugs and
mm-hmm.
not.
Mm-hmm.
How can people at will do it without drugs?
Well, there are many techniques which have been developed by shamanistic cultures all over the world that allow us to enter altered states of consciousness without using drugs, very, very effectively. And these include rhythmic drumming, certain kinds of music, certain kinds of dance. I wouldn't rule out hypnosis as a technique for entering altered states of consciousness. Of course, we all enter an altered state of consciousness every night when we fall asleep. We should not ignore our dreams. In modern society, it's an insult to call somebody a dreamer because we so love the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness. But in ancient times, dreams were regarded as a valid way of knowing. And that it was recognized that valid and useful information came to us through dreams. But it's the case that the greater majority of shamanistic cultures around the world do use the visionary plants that have evolved alongside us as their allies in entering altered states of consciousness at will. And again, the puritanical streak in Western society tends to regard this as somehow wrong, although if we think it through and realize that brain chemistry is involved in every experience we have, I think we would discover that we're being illogical somehow it seems too easy, you know, to consume certain visionary plants, and it just seems we kind of feel from the puritanical background that that Western cultures come from, we kind of feel that, you know, there should be agonizing work and pain in order to achieve these visionary states, and it seems somehow wrong that they can be achieved quickly using plants. But of course, the real important thing is what you do with the visionary state afterwards. I mean, my view is, you know, why walk 500 miles when you can take the train? The point is the destination that you get to and what you then do with the information that you get at that destination. And the process of integrating and acting upon visionary experiences, that's where the real hard work begins, where the individual is shown a different side of reality, perhaps is given information about himself or herself that is really important in adjusting their behavior. That's when the real work begins. It becomes with what we do with the visions. And therefore, I'm in favor of making it easier and more direct for people to attain the visionary state and providing a nurturing cultural background that will then allow us to integrate those visions and use them to improve our lives and indeed the quality of our society.
Okay, let's go to Florida. JJ, first time caller. Hi, JJ.
Yes, sir. How you guys doing tonight, man?
Okay, thanks.
Fine, thank you.
Just a couple questions for you here, Graham.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually a big fan. I actually kind of started listening to your work, I want to say last year in 2008, is when I actually watched one of your things from George Norrie's show on
right.
YouTube. I'm not sure what the actual date was.
Right.
That's when I actually saw it at first, and I thought you were a very interesting guy. But and I don't want to offend you when I ask this next question because it's actually not meant to. It's just I don't know. But also, you know, I got your book, Supernatural. It's like a 600-page book, but, you know, it looks like it's going to be good. I'm definitely going to read that.
Right.
And I also got the 2012 movie you guys just did with Jim Mars and such. So
indeed.
Those should be good. But, you know, as far as I was just wondering, like, are you a scientist or are you like a lay person?
I'm a human being. I'm a journalist by training. My objective, my training has taught me to look into things, to investigate things, to dig up facts. The answer to your question is no, I'm not a scientist. I don't ever claim to be a scientist. And actually, I don't want to be a scientist. I think science, although it's done many wonderful good things, has also done terrible harm on our planet. And I think we need alternative points of view, which are nevertheless argued logically and based on real research. And that's where I've really tried to place myself, as providing an alternative point of view to science, but from a rigorous perspective.
Okay, so you're basically an investigator then. Okay, I see. That makes
I'm an investigative journalist. That's my background. That's all I am. I'm an investigative journalist with, I hope, an open mind.
Yeah, well, you got an open mind, man, no doubt about it. But I wanted to ask you a second quick question here, and I'll let you go real quick. I was just wondering, you know, generally speaking, like if you could talk about like some upcoming stuff that you'll be doing. I mean, you were talking about how you would like to get people more involved with going into these new states of consciousness and things like that. And I'm all for that. But you're saying that, like, the authorities are, like, stopping people from doing that. I mean, how are they doing that? And I would like to actually work to try and stop them. I mean,
well,
it's
done, of course, primarily through the war on drugs and the drug laws, which have handed over the keys to our consciousness to massive, publicly funded, armed state bureaucracies. And somehow the con trick is so cleverly done that most of us accept this without question. We demand our independence. We demand our freedom, our right as individuals, even our right to own guns. And yet we passively accept that our government, those men in suits, may control what we experience or do not experience with our own consciousness. I think this is a fundamental human rights issue. The right of the adult to explore his or her own consciousness in the privacy of their own home or in sacred settings without doing any harm to others. And I think that Americans and the Brits and all of the rest of the world need to wake up to this fundamental human right, which we are presently refusing illogically when we ourselves come from cultures that defend the freedom of the individual. There could be no more important freedom than the freedom of consciousness. And the whole history of human culture shows us that the exploration of consciousness through visionary plants is of great importance. This is one of the issues I go into in depth in Supernatural, and therefore we must resist this on human rights grounds, this passive acceptance of the government's right to hold the keys to our consciousness. As I always say, If I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I'm not sovereign over anything. And let's not pretend that we live in free societies when our society will send us adults. I'm not talking about children. I do believe children's access to these substances should be controlled in the same way that we control children's access to alcohol. I'm talking about adults and adult responsibility. And it always stuns me that the Republican Party, which is so much in favor of the freedom of the individual adult and so much in favor of adult responsibility, nevertheless harshly advocates terrible penalties against people who use visionary plants to explore their own consciousness. This is a fundamentally philosophical, illogical position for the Republican Party to find itself in, and I think it needs to think about it again.
When you were doing all your research over all these years, Graham, was there an area that when you stumbled across it, you simply said, oh my God, I can't believe this?
Well, yes. Very much so, and particularly for my research into supernatural, for which reason I went down to the Amazon. I spent 5 weeks in the jungle, sitting down with Amazonian shamans and drinking the visionary brew called ayahuasca. It means the vine of the dead or the vine of souls. And it's used in the Amazon to access the spirit world and the teachings of the spirit world, and used particularly for healing because the Amazonian shamans believe that we can only properly heal ourselves if we understand the full context in which we're immersed. If we think that we're simply material beings and that there's nothing else to us but the matter of which our bodies are made, then we will never achieve a proper healing. We have to integrate the spiritual realm as well. And what ayahuasca, the vine of souls, allows us to do is to enter that realm and interact with the intelligent entities that live there. In the Amazon, they believe that a particular entity lies behind the ayahuasca vine. And this entity is envisaged sometimes in the form of a majestic human woman and sometimes in the form of a gigantic serpent, a boa constrictor, an anaconda type of serpent. And I, under the influence of ayahuasca, like many who drink ayahuasca, have met this being. And I met her at a time when I was very we always speak of her in the female form. And I realize for those who have not drunk ayahuasca how strange this may sound. But you do have a direct spiritual contact with a being who loves the earth and who loves human beings and who comes to us with a feeling of love. Her business is the planet, but she has time for the individual human. And I have encountered this being, and she wrapped herself around my body and rested that huge head on my shoulders and looked me in the eyes. I was feeling very low. I was feeling very negative about myself. And she said, you know, it's okay to love yourself. And she just beamed so much love and warmth into me over the 2 hours that this experience lasted, that it was utterly, utterly transformatory. And I could never emerge from that experience and believe that the world is as simple and as materialistic as our scientists insist. Yes, that was a transformatory experience for me.
Fred in Florida, east of the Rockies. Hi, Fred. How are you?
How are you?
Good.
On the consciousness plane, and you postulated that you could possibly meet aliens by changing your consciousness. When you have out-of-body experience, that's a change of consciousness. And I don't remember a lot of people saying that do have out-of-body experiences saying they meet aliens.
No, they meet spirits. They construe them as spirits in that sense. But many of the encounters have similar elements to that. An out of body experience is when your consciousness is released from the material envelope in which it is briefly contained while we live on this planet. And if that out of body experience also accompanies a near death experience, if you're having that out of body experience because your physical body is actually dying or dead, then it plays an important transition role in moving you from one state to the next, so that you often get a complete life review. You get the chance to look at everything that you did with your life. You get the chance to learn the lessons that you were meant to learn while you were here. So sometimes out-of-body experiences are also near-death experiences. Then the patient is recovered and they have this memory and this realization that consciousness is separate from the body and that it goes on forever. So I think it's part of the overall phenomenon that I'm describing, but a very specific part of it.
Another thing I can't understand, and George, maybe you can help me on this, is people in the UFO community are not taken the thing, what Ed Grimsley is showing, which should answer a lot of questions with his night vision goggles. He's showing UFOs battling each other, moving around in different ways that are not satellites and all that. Nobody's really taking this serious. Why is this?
Well, I don't know the researcher whose work you refer to, but I can tell you why nobody takes any of this seriously, because there is a huge mind control operation in our society to stop us taking it seriously. Our society doesn't want us to know about these things. It wants to keep us narrowly programmed as consumers and producers of material goods, and it doesn't want us thinking about the wider extraordinary reality that surrounds us.
Indeed. Next up, let's go to Seattle, Washington. Hello, Brian. Thank you for holding.
Hey, Graham. Hey, George. How you doing?
Sure thing.
Graham, I just got back from actually approving Amazon drinking ayahuasca. And
oh, wonderful.
It was
wonderful.
Amazing. And I loved what you talked about in Supernatural with the therianthropic beings and,
yes.
And then topics and everything.
Yes.
I do visual art, and that's how I integrate these experiences back into my life. But I was just wondering... have you integrated your experiences with altered states into your life, and have these experiences opened up paths of studies beyond what you've written in Supernatural? Like, where is it going, and how have these altered states opened you up?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. Ayahuasca has given a gift of art all over the planet. There is extraordinary visionary art being created by artists who've worked with ayahuasca, opening up whole new realms of artistic endeavor, just amazing stuff. In my case, I'm not gifted with art. I can't draw to save my life. I can't paint. My hand and eye don't work that way. My gift appears to be with words. And the gift that ayahuasca has given to me is a novel. I've just finished writing a whole novel, which involves time travel and spirit worlds and one character today and one character 24,000 years ago linked through the spirit world, fighting a battle of good against evil. And this novel has just been handed over to my publisher. And it's a gift to me from ayahuasca. The whole plot, the whole story was given to me in a vision. Now, it won't be published for another year or so, and I'm not at liberty to talk about the title, but yes, I can say that I've had a huge creative impulse that has come from these experiences and has led me in the direction for the first time in my life to writing fiction rather than non-fiction.
Okay, good. Thanks, Brian. Next up, Los Angeles we go. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Graham Hancock, I met you, your wife, years ago when you were in Hollywood. I was unsuccessful in trying to get you connected with the Today Show.
Right.
But now I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally persuaded by the argument that the Sphinx's head is more recent than the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if the hole could date back to the age of Leo and therefore have originally been the head of a lion about 10,000 years ago.
Absolutely. In fact, I make that case in Fingerprints of the Gods and in The Message of the Sphinx. Thanks for mentioning this, because I mentioned John Anthony West and Robert Schock, but I forgot to mention Robert Bobal and his astonishing work on the Orion correlation and the correlation of the Sphinx with Leo.
He's good.
And Robert is a brilliant, brilliant guy, and his book, The Orion Mystery, is one of the great breakthrough works in this field. And in short, yes, that's what Robert is arguing, that the Sphinx is a marker for the age of Leo when the sun on the spring equinox rose against the background of the constellation of Leo, and therefore the Sphinx on the ground is the terrestrial counterpart of this celestial image, which is the sun in Leo, which, as a matter of fact, occurred around 10,500 B.C. 12,500 years ago.
It is amazing work, Graham, isn't it? How many people like you are out there doing this?
Well, I think there's quite a lot of us. Some of us have been fortunate to be able to make it a full-time endeavor, but I highly value the work of individuals all over the world who write to me through my website and introduce new and extraordinary ideas, and I try to give them a forum on my website to publish their information. I think that everybody has something to bring to this mystery. There should be no specialists, no experts. We're all people with open minds who can bring new information to the inquiry.
I met you in Washington. Do you go to many conferences?
I've been cutting it back a bit while I've been writing my novel, but now that the novel is finished, I'm going to be going back to conferences again. I don't have anything immediately coming up, but I'm open for it.
You're in the United Kingdom right now, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in England, and it's coming up to 10 a.m. here.
My gosh, I just saw you a few days ago almost. You're
yes,
all over the map.
Seems like yesterday.
Indeed, indeed. Give out your website one more time for us.
Yeah, it's www.grahamhancock.com, GRAHAMHANCOCK, and all the information is available there.
And the book is called Supernatural.
Supernatural.
Nice. All right.
Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind.
Right.
Thank you so much, George.
Thank you for being on the program. Quite a guy. And that was kind of neat, because when I was in Washington, D.C. at the X Conference, there he was tapping me on the back, and I turned around and went, "Hi," and he said, "It's me, Graham Hancock," and here he is on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget, tomorrow program, Robert Zimmerman joins us as we talk about the universe in a mirror. It's about the Hubble Space Telescope. For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.